Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck of katelovingschenck.com and the author of the Prayer Prescription Series. The Prayer Prescription Series is the sponsor of this show. Please go to katelovingschenck.com to receive a book I wrote called The Self-Healing Manifesto. My guest today is Julie Simon, author of The Emotional Eater's Repair Manual, a practical mind-body-spirit guide for putting an end to overeating and dieting. This book makes you think a whole different way about what we eat, why we eat other than eating to survive, and helps the reader create a whole new paradigm surrounding the way we treat ourselves. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Julie Simon. Hello, Julie.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
I'm so good. Wonderful to have you on the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
As we were talking just before the show, your book is so much more than a guide to eating healthy foods. Can you give us a rundown of ways we sabotage ourselves, stemming essentially from not being loved and how we don't love ourselves?
Well, that's a good way of putting it, about not loving ourselves. You know, I think what most emotional eaters have in common is that they came from backgrounds that in some way or another were undernourishing, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you didn't have loving caregivers or that you had to have trauma, but even sometimes loving caregivers don't really know how to soothe or comfort us. You know, often we have mothers or grandmothers who bake us cookies when we're upset, and perhaps they don't know how to explore what's going on. So it's really easy for us at some point in our lives to start to turn to food as a way to meet our needs, you know, for soothing and for comfort, for distraction, for excitement. And we can start to get into trouble.
Well, you see that, just as you said before, just you know, in your what you just said, that everybody wants to comfort foods. You know, there's so many comfort foods that we bring out when we're together, and it's considered to be not very polite to have people over to your house if you're not serving food. So everybody's always eating. Everywhere you go, people are eating, especially here in this country. And then the whole dieting phenomenon is something that only happens in America, because people are not dieting in other cultures or other societies, and they have a really healthy attitude about, I mean, everybody gets together to eat, but they eat in longer stretches, they have courses, they converse, and here everybody is in such a hurry that it just is partly one of the reasons why we are in the dilemma that we're in. What do you think?
Well, I think, like you said, I think there are so many pieces to it, especially when you compare it to other cultures. Like, I think here in America now, we have so little extended family, and in all over America, people are struggling to find community. You know, I think we've never seen anything like what we have now in the 21st century, where people live next door to each other. They don't even know each other. They don't know their neighbors. Their sisters and brothers live 3,000 miles away, you know, divorce, change of job, leaves people feeling extremely lonely. And then I think, you know, when we come together and at these gatherings, we have what we call hyperpalatable foods, you know, these very delectable foods full of sugar, salt, and fat. And they immediately alter our brain chemicals. And so if we're struggling, like I think many of us are in America, if we're struggling with loneliness, if we're struggling with a lack of connection in our lives to ourselves and to others, if we're under a lot of stress, which many of us are today, it's so easy to turn to these kind of foods. And the other thing that I would add, which is different than other cultures and different than years past, is that food, especially highly processed, refined food and delectable food, is so convenient today. You go on any block and you'll find, you know, three corners full of highly processed food that you can get in 5 minutes.
Right.
So it's the setup is we're set up now for trouble. With a capital T.
Years ago, the junk food wasn't laden with genetically modified foods as it is now. It's even those foods are much more dangerous to our health than the processed food that my generation was raised with. But not to say that that was good food ever, but it's much more dangerous now to our health.
Yes, and even the junk food today is more packed with mind and body altering chemicals, you know, dyes and preservatives and additives and even simple things like the wheat, for example, today is so different than the wheat of 100 years ago, and it and the proteins in it now are so different than the proteins of the wheat of many, many years ago. We've got more gluten-sensitive people than we've ever had. We've got more food addiction than we've ever had because of the altered food, because of the hyperpalatability of the food. So it's just on that physical front, even if you have no emotional issues going on, you're probably going to find that it's hard to resist certain foods.
Right. Well, I found it interesting, a point you made in your book about food addictions. We think that allergies, is that we think that an allergy to something means that you would generally not go near it. But with food allergies, you are drawn to those foods. I never even thought about that before.
Yeah, it's a funny twist on the idea of allergy, in that with food allergies, you often feel better after you ingest food allergens, you know, and part of that is, like I was saying, for example, with wheat, I know I have an allergy to wheat, and so when I eat the wheat, what happens is that the proteins in the wheat are they pass the blood-brain barrier very quickly because it's refined into a flour, and it attaches to endorphin receptors in the brain. So the minute I eat it, I get an increase of endorphins in my brain. And, you know, this big, giant feel-good. So it's an allergen. So how do I know it's an allergen? Because my nose gets stuffy. I get a little sluggish and fatigued the next day. My GI tract gets a little inflamed from it. So it's triggering an immune reaction. But before it triggers an immune reaction, I get a big feel-good. So that makes me want more. And that's how food allergies work, is that we feel better after we ingest the food allergen. And then even though we feel worse later, we still feel compelled to go get more.
Well, I think that we feel better so quickly that that's what we remember. And then, but the thing about feeling bad doesn't happen right away, so we may not necessarily make that connection.
Yeah, that part's so true. I just had a client of mine who read my book, and she's heard me talk about her getting bread out of her diet for a long, long time, and I guess she was sneaking it back in without telling me. And she said, you know, after I read your book, I decided to run an experiment, and I took the wheat out, you know, for 1 month. And she said, and then when I put it back in, she said, this whole first week, my nose was running and my head was stuffy. And she said, I realized that I just lived with that. I was just living with that forever. And she said, it didn't dawn on me until I took the weed out that that had gone away. And that the minute I added the weed back, that was back. So, yes.
Now,
food allergies can be delayed reactions. You can get reactions. Food allergy reactions can be 72 hours later. So it can be hard to track.
Yes. I was wondering if I know when I have given up wheat in the past, and I think I must have an allergy to it too, because of a terrible bloating, for one, that I lose weight when I don't eat wheat. I wondered if your friend also had noticed that.
I don't know if she noticed that, but I'll tell you, when I first went off wheat, I dropped weight immediately. I remember that because I worked with an allergist when I first did it. And I dropped weight immediately when I went off it. And, yes, I mean, because one of the signs, you know, of inflammation is fluid retention. So some of that is just water loss. But, you know, if that water is gone all the time, it still pounds off. You know, it still feels better, right?
Well, and not only did I lose weight and everything that you just described, but I felt so much better without it. That right now, just talking about it, I'm going to go off of it again. I mean, I just know I have to. I know I am allergic to it. I just know it. And,
yeah,
and
you know what I say to people with that is that if you, the best way to do it is to think of it as like your treat food. So I stay off wheat flour pretty much all the time. And then it's like my cheat food, you know, like if I'm out somewhere and I just want to have, you know, like half a bagel or something, you know, I'll have it. But it's just occasional, right? It's not a staple food. And the truth is, even when I have it occasionally, I get a reaction pretty fast.
Wow.
But you don't have to be 100% perfect, but you do have to predominantly have some of these foods out of your diet. Now, the one caveat I'll put there is that when I'm working with emotional eaters, often if we even talk about removing any foods, that feels like restriction and deprivation. So if any of your listeners are saying, oh, my God, you know, I just cannot give up, you know, my toast in the morning, or I can't give up my scones, or, you know, I just don't want to never have a cookie, or then I say to them, first of all, don't think of it as never, you know, because you can often introduce it a little bit here and there. But if you really feel like it's just so depriving to give it up, then you can do what we call a rotary diversified diet, where if you have, let's say, wheat on Monday, you don't have it for 4 days. You don't have it till Thursday. And that starts to reduce the load of the allergen in your body, and you'll start to feel better. Because that's what we're after. You know, in my book, the whole key is to get yourself back into balance, right? To get all your... and to get all your signals working so that you can pay attention to them and they can guide you. And so if you're putting foods in your body that throw your signaling system off, they shoot your brain chemicals up and they create, you know, cravings, and then you can't, it's hard to trust your signals. So that's what we're after, is for your listeners to try and think of it as, you know, taking the best care of your body and staying in balance, rather than thinking of, oh, what do I have to get rid of? You know, what am I, it's, my life is going to be, what, just eating lettuce leaves? How boring. You know, not to think of it like that.
Well, the word deprivation signals me to the amount, I think that deprivation is directly related to the food disorders that we have with bulimia and anorexia, that people are purposely depriving themselves of foods under those conditions. And that word deprivation is key, I think. The whole concept of deprivation is key to understanding what happens with those diseases of eating disorders.
Right, and even binge eating disorder.
Yes, yes.
Even binge eating disorder. That's why when I work with people, I generally don't start off by saying, take this or that food, you know, out of your diet. Generally, the way I work is I start by asking them to add certain foods to their diet. Because it's such a different concept to think about adding more whole unprocessed plant foods to your eating
right.
plan. And this is the way I always work with people, and I say, okay, you know, we'll talk about allergens, but I'm not going to ask you to start removing. I'm going to ask you to start adding things. And people will say to me, because, you know, there's been so much diet mentality for so many years, I'll say to people, okay, I want you to add a banana. And they'll say, a whole banana?
Oh.
Yeah, a whole banana, even two. And I'll say, I want you to add a potato or two. A whole potato, like a russet potato? I thought that's too much starch, right? Meanwhile,
yeah.
they're eating cookies and refined
yeah,
flours.
Yeah. Well, right? as you point out, if you're adding these good foods, the other foods become less palatable. And you don't want
they
to
do,
eat them.
And you crowd them out. That's the key.
Mm-hmm.
You crowd them out. You start to notice that an apple, while it's not super, super exciting and thrilling like a cookie, the apple is very satiating. It,
yes.
it has fiber in it. It has all kinds of phytonutrients. It balances your brain chemistry and your body chemistry. It kind of calms everything down, and you're not looking for anything else. But then,
yes.
then you start to notice that if instead you have half a candy bar, that starts to stir stuff up. You want
mm-hmm.
more candy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And so you start to notice a difference when you add the whole foods and you let the whole foods crowd out those other foods.
That's cool. That really is. It's a whole new way of looking at it.
It is, and you can do it so simply. Like I'll say to people, okay, do you like pea soup? And they'll say, yeah, I like pea soup. I say, okay, would you add some pea soup in during the week? Do you like a yam? Yes, I love a yam. Okay, would you add a yam in somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
How about brown rice? Yes. I mean, most of these foods people will say they really enjoy.
Yes.
And I'll ask them to start adding them. And then they'll come back and they'll say to me, you know, I'm eating the brown rice and the potatoes. There really isn't room for the bread, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
I'm satisfied. That's the key. Is most with my emotional eaters, I'm always looking for the word, I'm satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But emotionally, spiritually, and physically.
Yeah. And I don't always start from the physical front, but sometimes, you know, that's the easiest place to make
yeah.
the first few changes.
Yeah, we have to start somewhere, and sometimes people need to start different places than somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But I had an aha thing that happened to me with, it's a very simple, that one of the principles that you talk about is paying attention to hunger and fullness signals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this takes into account just becoming more in tune with our needs to eat when hungry, drink when thirsty, rest at different intervals throughout the day. And just a whole concept of taking care of ourselves. Now, just to say that the other day, well, just now, for instance, I ate a beautiful spinach sog with some rice, and I ate it. And right afterwards, I still felt hungry. But after giving it about 15 to 20 minutes, I am no longer hungry, even after an hour after eating it. And I felt totally satisfied. But it wasn't totally feeling satisfied at right afterwards, and if I would have paid attention to just that signal of still being hungry, that was not a true signal that my body was giving me. I just had to give it some time before I felt satisfied.
Right, and the question is, did you eat really slowly when you ate?
This time I did, yes. I wanted to really take, well, I tend to eat too fast, so I probably slowed down, we're not going to get into shoulds, but it would be better for me to slow down even more.
Yeah, because I would say that if you then found, you know, after a certain time that you weren't hungry, that you probably could have eaten a little bit slower.
Mm-hmm.
You might have
mm-hmm.
registered that. Or the other thing is that maybe another bite or two of something would have done it right then.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's not so terrible. The first thing is, if you're eating really fast, you do have to slow down because it does take the brain, you know, the brain and the stomach time to register satiety. But if you're eating slow enough,
mm-hmm.
You know, your body is so phenomenally wise. When you start to put food in, it starts to calculate the caloric density of what you're eating. So if you're
mm-hmm.
having a salad, for example, and your body deems that it's not really enough calories you're still going to get a hunger signal. That's why eating a plate of leaves will not leave you satisfied. You know, but when you add some, you know, some beans and some brown rice, then you'll feel satiated. So your body's doing all those calculations. And if
That's
you eat slow enough,
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's your body is even calculating how much fat is stored in your fat cells to so that it can shut off your appetite so you won't get you won't gain weight and get eaten by a predator. That's how incredible your signal system is. That's why you have to really pay attention to it and honor it, because it's going to tell you, it's going to tell you when to eat. It's going to tell you what to eat, you know, via cravings. And it's going to shoot off a hormone called leptin to stop your appetite. Mm-hmm. And when all the signals work, you know, I always say, some of my clients will say, you know, they get into trouble with nuts, for example. And I'll say to them, you know, when your signals start to work, you won't get into trouble with anything. Like when I'm eating nuts, for example, I take out a handful and I'm eating them. And just right about where I finish my handful, I start feeling kind of nutted out. You know what I mean? It feels like it's too rich. I've had enough rich food. The nuts are very rich. They're full of fat. And my signals tell me, like, I couldn't eat one more nut. Because my signals work really well. But if your signals, if you've been overriding your signals for a long, long time, or if you're wolfing, you're eating really, really fast, or you're not paying attention, you know, you're eating, you're snacking mindlessly, you just have hand in a bag, you know, your hand to your mouth, then you're not going to hear these signals.
Yeah, so you have to slow down. There's so many things we have to do. Number one would be slowing down, I think.
Yeah, and honor the act of eating. Honor that as, you know, a special time that you shut the television off, you, you know, turn the computer off or move away from it and just take time to be with your meal. I mean, I know we can't always do that, and sometimes we have to eat on the run. But if we're going to eat on the run, then we need to kind of pay attention to at least how much we've taken on our plate, you know, and give our bodies time to signal us.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the body balancing principles that you do, that you were just talking about and that you outlined in part two of your book? Because that is fascinating, how the body knows. And that body knows when you're thinking self-defeating thoughts, too.
It does, and we'll get to that. Well, the first body balancing principle, like we said, is to eat when you're hungry, to really pay attention to a hunger signal and stop when you're full and listen to your cravings. And the one thing I'll say also about hunger is that everybody's hunger signals vary. So some people have very subtle hunger cues. That's how I am. I could get up in the morning. I could go for hours and hours and hours without eating. So I have very subtle hunger cues. Other people, hunger is like an emergency, right? Like if I don't eat now, I'm going to be irritable and all systems are shutting down. So you want to pay attention to your signals. And if you're kind of the more slow, subtle type, you want to eat, let's say, within an hour and a half of waking up, even if you're not super hungry. Because eating revs your metabolism, and that's really good to get the body going. Then you're going to pay attention to what you're craving. You know, if oranges look good and you want two oranges, that's what looks good. Eat two oranges. You know, you don't have to worry when you're eating foods that are consistent with your human design, which are unprocessed whole plant foods. You don't have to worry about quantity, because your signals will tell you. Like if I get some great grapefruits or something, often I want to eat two, and I'll eat two, but I can tell you by the time I'm done with two, I don't want three.
Right.
My signals tell me, or if I want, I'm eating a banana, it's so good, maybe I want another quarter of another banana, but then my signals say, no more bananas. Even when you're hungry, listen to your cravings. Principle number two is, you know, eat foods consistent with your human design. Those are the unprocessed whole plant foods, as much as you can, because the other thing I would say about this is that fiber, your system, was designed to get an accurate read on calorie counting, right? Remember, your body's so phenomenal. It does all that. that it can only get an accurate read if you eat foods full of fiber, right?
Yeah.
So when you eat foods full of fiber, it starts to trigger the stretch receptors in your stomach, and it starts to start the whole signaling process of how much you've eaten, the caloric density, all that stuff. But if you eat foods that don't have fiber, these are modern foods, right? 100, 200 years ago, we didn't have, Krispy Kreme. We didn't have these fiberless concoctions. So what I like to suggest to people, a simple step, is to think about eating something with fiber at every meal, right? Just that simple. So in your breakfast, oatmeal has plenty of fiber. You could have a smoothie with, fruit and I like to make a smoothie with spinach and fruit. There's plenty of fiber there. In your lunch, you could have, even if you just threw a few carrots in, right? Add a cucumber. If you like red or yellow peppers, eat a red pepper, eat a yellow pepper. Just throw some fiber in. Our baboon cousins, eat about 90 grams of fiber a day. And, we're lucky if we consume 15. So that's something to really think about is fiber, fiber, fiber. Get in as much fiber as you can. It's the way your system is built to work and to get reads. So then the third principle is to address body and brain chemistry imbalances. And so if you have any genetically inherited imbalances, like your thyroid could be off or your adrenal glands are off from stress, or your sex hormones are off. Lots of women come to me with PMS and perimenopausal symptoms. All of these kind of imbalances can lead to food cravings. So if you have PMS, you can have very severe food cravings. If you're low thyroid, you can be craving food, to lift you up. If your adrenals are whacked out, you might be craving caffeinated beverages. So you have to kind of speak to your healthcare practitioner and just get some tests run. And in the book, I give lists of symptoms. If your thyroid's off, if your adrenals are off, if your sex hormones are off, if your insulin is off, if your blood sugar is off, what that might look like, what symptoms you might have. And, that's going to, like I said, lead to food cravings, overeating, and weight gain. And then you also might have your brain chemicals might be off. Now, sometimes brain chemicals can be off just because of stress, can just be a temporary thing, or you could have inherited low brain chemicals. You could have something we call dysthymia, which is low brain chemicals. You might feel a little depressed. You might feel a little low mental energy. You might have anxiety. So when your brain chemicals are off, this also can trigger cravings. Because remember, I said some of those hyperpalatable foods will stimulate brain chemicals, and they'll attach to receptors in the brain, and they'll lift your chemicals. So that's why a lot of people who have low brain chemicals are very attracted to caffeine and very attracted to nicotine, because these things raise the brain chemicals. And there are some really nice holistic treatments today using amino acids and vitamins, and even exercise that.
Yes.
Can address low or imbalanced brain chemicals, which, again, when your brain chemicals are low or imbalanced, they can lead, again, to food cravings, low energy, weight gain. So we want to address that. Then the other piece in that chapter on body and brain imbalance is food allergens, which we talked about earlier. You want to address, you want to look at your eating, at the foods you're eating, and in the book I talk about which are the most common food allergens, like wheat and sugar and dairy for sure. No animal in nature that drinks the milk of another animal, so it's not so healthy that we're doing that as humans.
Right, right.
Even though we can do it, it's not very good for us. And then a lot of people have allergies to soy and to corn and to tree nuts, shrimp, things like that. Or seafood or shellfish. So you want to kind of check into food allergies because, again, that can trigger food cravings, overeating, and weight gain. And then I also talk in that chapter about stress, about reducing stress, because stress increases cortisol levels, which again will trigger food cravings and overeating. So you can just see that ever the body is out of balance, the body and the brain are out of balance, food cravings can be triggered.
Yeah.
And then comes overeating and the weight gain. And so this can mimic emotional eating. Some people come to me and they say, oh, I must be an emotional eater. You know, I just, and then I have them keep a food log and I look at what they're eating and I say, well, you know, probably some of this is emotional, but it's looking to me like a lot of it's physical.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a nice thing because that often can be cleaned up fairly quickly without, like I said earlier, without feeling restricted or without feeling deprived. We just start to, you know, get some adjustments going, maybe adjust the brain chemicals a little bit. You know, if some of the hormones are out of whack, get those adjusted a little bit. And I often have people feeling so much better right away. And then also, if you're feeling better in a higher functioning body and brain, you're much more, it's much easier to find the willingness to work on emotional skill building.
Right.
And the last two things in that part of the book that you asked about, that middle part of the book is about when overeating is driven by body imbalance. And so the last two chapters are on moving your body, so getting the right amount of exercise. And I'd like to remind people that research shows that it's okay to break your exercise up even into 10-minute segments. So everybody can do this. You know, you can find 3 10-minute segments in a day, you know, to do a little bit of exercise. Doesn't have to be continuous. And then the last chapter in that is, in terms of balancing your brain and your body, is sleeping to satiation. So, you know, we're in a culture where everything is in debt. You know, we all have financial debt. We all have sleep debt. Sleep is the first thing we give up, you know, when our schedules are stressful. And yet, sleep is one of the most important things we can do for ourselves, is to get adequate sleep. And the National Sleep Foundation suggests that we get 7 to 9 hours a night. Below 7, you're in danger for damaging your health, not just gaining weight, but really damaging your health and your longevity. And even sleeping over 9, you're damaging your health. But you must get the right amount, and the way you determine how much you need is you sleep to satiation. So what that means is, let's say you take a weekend where you don't have to be up, go to bed at your normal time, and don't get up, don't set an alarm, and see when you would naturally wake up. Like, if that's 8.5 hours later, that's probably what you need most nights.
Now, have you found that when people start eating foods that put their bodies and minds and spirit into balance, that these so-called sleep disorders, which is a huge epidemic in our society, that people are really, do you find that people can sleep better?
Oh, definitely that they can sleep better, much, much better. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, first of all, a lot of people are having caffeine, and that's desperately affecting their sleep.
Yes.
But also, a lot of people have very poor sleep, what we call sleep hygiene habits, so they're working up late on the computer. And our eyes were not meant to be stimulated with that kind of light. You know, when you stimulate your brain with that kind of light at night, cortisol levels increase. And the minute cortisol increases, you're not going to sleep well, because what's supposed to happen is cortisol goes down as the day moves on, and then melatonin kicks in. Melatonin is a sleep hormone. Cortisol is the energizing, get-you-going hormone. So if we are turning on bright lights at night, right, we're on the phone, we're working on the computer, we've got the television going and the glaring light of the television, right? Our sleep hygiene is poor. We need to turn off the computer, turn down the lights, not have a television in our bedroom probably. And let our bodies quiet down, let the cortisol levels get low, let the melatonin levels go up. When people start doing it, they start noticing not only do they sleep better, but they feel better during the day. They're less irritable or grumpy. They're less fatigued. They're less apt to mindlessly snack and grab energy foods and drinks. So it's a whole gestalt, right?
It is. What do you think about some of us have to work night work, and that what adjustments can we make to balance out our circadian rhythms under those circumstances, because it is exhausting to work nights because of just everything you described.
When you say nights, do you mean like work all the way
all
through
night,
the night?
All night long, yeah.
You mean into the morning?
Yes.
I think that's very challenging on the body.
It is.
Mm-hmm. I've known some people who have done that. I think you have to really have good blackout shades in your
mm-hmm.
house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when your body is ready to go down for sleep, you know, you've really got to... I've seen people mess themselves up because when they're ready to sleep, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm. 'cause
maybe the next day they don't have to work the night, or, you know, it's probably easier if you have the same shift every single day, but when you
yes.
don't, yeah, I think it's very challenging. You've got to arrange you've got to start to change that whole setup, but you still need to sleep when it's time for you to sleep. And if that means blacking out all shades, wearing eye shades on your eyes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right?
And then it has to do with the way we eat as night shifters is completely whacks out the body, that's for sure. You know,
that's the other thing.
Binging at night and whatever. But it's something that more and more people have to work nights, and I think that it just messes up not only the circadian rhythm, but you don't even know what to eat or when to sleep or how much to sleep, and it's exhausting.
Yeah, somehow I don't think, you know, anybody should be required to do that, you know, daily.
Yes.
Because it's really throwing... I know I work late in the evenings in my practice. I don't work, you know, beyond 11 o'clock at night, but even when I work until 11 o'clock at night, it means I'm not eating until after 11, you know, because I often haven't had time for a dinner.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm eating at 11:45 at night, and then I want to stay up for a couple hours to digest. That's very challenging.
It is. So you have a business. You have a website that you can direct people to?
I do. The website is overeatingrecovery.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have, you know, for people who want to work with me, you know, I see people here in LA, and then I do phone sessions and Skype sessions. And I also have a 12-week program for emotional eaters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The program will be live in LA, and there'll also be upcoming a teleseminar series for people that aren't in LA. And the website has lots of goodies, too, lots of blog articles on there for people to read. And so
your overeatingrecovery.com will also have information about the 12-week program and also the live, the teleseminars that the 12-week program is a teleseminar, and then the live programs in Los Angeles.
Yes, the live program.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there, and they can order the book there. And they can even, it should hopefully be up very soon. If they want to sign up on my mailing list, they can also get 2 free chapters of the book to start off reading quickly.
Well, good. That's perfect. So I really enjoyed the part of your book where you described the spiritual reserves. You know, how some of the wonderful practices that are available to us to really get ourselves into balance along with everything else that we're putting into our mouths, as it were. So what spiritual practice do you personally practice?
Well, I actually practice all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're all really critical to me. I mean, the two practices that are the easiest for people to start with are learning to quiet their mind. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can start with just even some basic breathing exercises, you know, breathing in, counting 4 breaths, and then breathing out, counting 4 breaths, and learning to just focus on your breathing, and maybe doing that for 5 to 10 minutes, or even 2 minutes in a day to help lower cortisol levels and relax the body and relax the mind. And another very simple spiritual practice that I like people to practice is practicing gratitude.
Because often,
even as emotional eaters, you know, we often, most of us, you know, we're focused on what's not working in our lives. What's not working, what we don't have, what we wish we had. And we really fail to stop for a second and think about all that we have. Like, for example, when I'm heading to work and I'm going to get in the shower and, you know, do my thing in the shower, I often stand in the shower and I think for a moment how incredibly fortunate I am. To just be able to have a hot shower whenever I want it, right?
Right.
And that this is not common in many parts of the world. There is no opportunity, you know, for a hot shower.
That's
or when I'm going to the market and I'm buying food, I'll stop for a second and I'll look at the big truck that's bringing the food to the market and I think, wow, I am so fortunate. I don't have to go hunt my food down and pick it off a bush. I mean, sometimes I wish I could, but how fortunate I am that I can just drive to a place that has mass quantities of it for me to buy, right?
Yes.
So gratitude is a really important practice. It really centers you.
Mm-hmm.
It quiets all of that complaining.
Yeah.
That inner complaining that we all do. And it starts to connect you to the bounty.
That's a connection, yes.
Mm-hmm. To the bounty that's around you all the time that you know, we all tend to forget.
It's a remedy for the self-defeating thoughts that we were talking about earlier that really bombard people's and some really sabotage people's ability to really be joyously productive, I think.
Yes, I think so,
and
too.
And you talk about reframing negative, doubtful thoughts. Can you? That's a very good practice.
It's a really good practice. Let me do one thing. Can I do one thing before we do that?
Absolutely.
Let me just, because this will lead right into that, let me just talk for a second about that when emotional eaters, you know, for any of your listeners, when, you know, they find themselves wanting to eat when they're not hungry or wanting to eat way beyond full or just regularly wanting to grab unhealthy comfort foods.
Mm-hmm.
There's a skill in the book that I teach. It's the very first skill because it's so critical of a skill. And it's called self-connection. And it's a very simple procedure that I have. It's called an inner conversation. So I just ask people to start by having a conversation with themselves. Like I said, when you want to grab food and you know you're not hungry or you want to keep eating, and you just ask yourself, well, what am I feeling? So we talked earlier about connecting to all of our body signals, hunger, fullness, cravings, fatigue, need for sleep. We also want to connect to our emotional signals. And this is a place where many people in fast-moving America today just are very disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even know. You say, what are you feeling? What were you feeling today? They don't even know what they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
People come to me and they'll say, well, I don't know. Could I be feeling sad, right? Or could maybe I was feeling anxious?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of sad that someone is asking and not even knowing, right?
Yes, yes.
And this is often because, and again, not to make our caregivers terrible, bad people, but often they didn't know how to model that for us, didn't teach us how to do that. So we start with this very basic skill of identifying what we're feeling. So I'm coming home from work, and I want to go get pizza and pasta, really cheesy, noodly pasta and pizza. That's what I want. But I kind of know that that's not the best for me. I know I have wheat allergies. I know that's going to kind of jack up my chemicals and make my nose stuffy. But that's what I really want to have, okay? So now I say to myself, what am I feeling? I'm driving home from work, and I say, well, I'm feeling drained. I'm feeling lonely. I'm feeling kind of empty. It wasn't a great day. Feeling frustrated. I'm feeling like I want excitement. Okay. So then part two of this inner conversation, what is it that I really need? Do I really need a cheesy pizza and noodle dish? no, that's not what I really need. I guess what I really need is some good companionship.
Mm-hmm.
I really need some good connection in my life. I need to work on finding a new job. I'm not happy with my job anymore. I need to feel more purpose in my life. I'm not feeling like what I'm doing is that purposeful. I need some hope. And I think I'm also needing some comfort tonight. I feel like I want some comfort. I want some soothing. Okay. Well, the truth is we really know that a pizza and a cheesy noodle dish is not going to do all that, right?
No, yeah.
It's going to be delicious, and it's going to be kind of soothing and comforting, but the truth is it's really not going to resolve any of the issues. So we'll be back hunting for something else tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm.
So the third step of the skill, this inner conversation, is to access an inner nourishing voice that can do all those things, that can soothe you and comfort you and be your companion and connect to you and reassure you and give you hope, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's
a
voice, what I call the inner nurturer, that we all must have. Some of us, it's a very tiny voice. We must have it, and we must develop it. And it does not develop unless you practice it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I like to say to a lot of emotional eaters is a lot of emotional eaters, rather than having an inner nurturer, they have an inner indulger.
Mm.
They have a voice that says, come on, you had a hard day. Let's just go get the pizza and the cheesy noodle dish, and we'll deal with it tomorrow. That's the inner indulger, right? And after you go with the inner indulger, what comes up later on, 2 hours later, is an inner critic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the inner critic says, that was really stupid that you went and had all of that food and you ate all of that. You said you would eat half and you ate the whole thing. And now we're going to gain weight. And this is just disgusting. And I feel terrible about myself, right?
Right.
So then comes the inner critic, and we'll talk about that in a second in terms of reframing those thoughts. So we need to have an inner nurturer, and the inner nurturer needs to also function as an inner limit setter, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what does she sound like? She sounds like, hi there, I know you've had a really hard day, and it's been pretty rough on this job lately, and it's been pretty frustrating. And I'm here with you, and I want to tell you how special you are and how wonderful you are and how much I care about you and how much I love you and how important you are to me. And I'm here with you, and I know that we can find something enjoyable for the evening. We don't need to have the pizza and the pasta. We can get something healthy, and then we can do something else that's nurturing and nourishing. You know, maybe we'll go home and listen to music, or maybe we'll watch a good movie. Or maybe we'll write in our journal. But I'm here with you, and I'm going to set a limit that, you know, we don't need to get all that. Or maybe I'm going to set a limit with you and say, let's just get one slice of pizza, not the whole pizza. Let's not get the cheesy noodle dish. Let's get one slice of pizza, and let's have a salad with it, right? So I'm the inner nurturer, and I'm the inner limit setter, and I'm here to help you meet those needs. Now, I say to people, initially when you have these inner conversations, if your inner nurturer is not well developed, it's not going to feel all that nurturing. And you're probably not going to want to practice it very often, because you're going to say, yeah, I had that inner conversation, and so what? I didn't feel any better. Okay, so I say to people, okay, so then go get the pizza and the cheesy noodle dish. But have the conversation first. And as you get practice at having these conversations with yourself, you're going to find over time that a shift occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to have something inside that nourishes you, right? That's where it all comes from.
Mm-hmm.
An internal, you know, happiness and joy and peace and all those goodies we're looking for, they're already inside. When we look for them in cheesy noodle dishes and pizzas, that's not where they are to be found. So we have to make that connection to ourselves. And that kind of ties into what you asked before about reframing self-defeating thoughts. So
let's say you
go ahead and indulge in the food, and then you start beating yourself up, right? Or you come home from work and you say, you know, that outfit I had on today looked terrible, and I'm just an overweight, you know, unattractive person and nobody will ever love me, right? Well, emotional eaters are often eating because their thoughts are so self-defeating. You know, they're not positive, they're critical, they're, you know, self-attacking. And so we have to learn, this is, you know, part of going inward, part of self-connection. We're identifying what am I feeling, we're identifying what am I needing, we're identifying what am I thinking. And then I have to take those thoughts and I have to use my inner nourishing voice and I have to reframe them into something different. So if I'm saying, I'm overweight and unattractive and no one's ever going to love me, maybe I need to reframe that by saying, I want to start today by loving myself. And that's where I can begin. Today, I choose to love myself unconditionally. Even if my body is overweight and even if I'm feeling unattractive, today I want to choose to love myself unconditionally. Now, I can hear all the things that everybody in my group and 12-week programs will say. All the yes buts will come immediately. But I can't love myself with this stomach. I can't love myself with these arms, right? Or with these flabby arms or with this, you know, extra weight under my chin, or, you know, I hear this all the time. I know where our work is, right? Because
you're right.
We have to learn how to see the essence of who we are and love that essence. We have to learn how to cheerlead ourselves. We have to learn how to have thoughts that are always self-affirming and self-loving. And this is not simple work. I mean, that's why in the book I devote an entire chapter, you know, to learning how to catch those thoughts, because you can really do damage to yourself, not just with eating, but in all kinds of ways. If your thoughts are really consistently self-defeating and critical and judgmental. So you have to be addressing that. And this is the internal work, is going inward and learning to identify all this stuff and work with it. And I give techniques and tools, and in the 12-week program, that's all we do, is we keep working on this stuff and trying to get some good recovery.
Right. It does take practice, and it does take a loving attitude towards yourself, because you can't love anybody else unless you love yourself.
No, and it doesn't feel good to dislike yourself so much.
It doesn't feel good.
Sometimes we have to go very deep underneath things, because people will say, you know, well, I have cellulite, so I'll never, ever love it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's so almost violent, you know?
It is. It is violent.
Right? To not embrace every part of ourselves, you know, at every step of the way, at every phase of our life's journey, it's critical, you know, to be able to say, you know, this is, you know, I always like to say one of the things that helped me learn unconditional love, it sounds crazy, was my cat. You know, my cat had, when I got her, she had had some kittens. And so, you know, she had like a kind of a poochy belly, you know, that kind of swooshed when she walked.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of looked funky in some ways. And I remember I used to look at her and I used to think, well, she's not like looking in the mirror and having misery every day about her her poochy belly, right? And I thought, she's just in joy. You know, she just has joy. And I thought, and she was my teacher. It sounds really crazy, but she was like one of my gurus.
Oh,
you know,
that love that. Love it. Yeah.
If she can just move through the world without this hyper-criticalness about her body, right, and, and her value and her worth, how can I do that as well?
Yes, animals really love themselves.
They
do. Our dogs and our cats.
And when they they get a leg cut off and they move on with three.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They just keep on trucking. And if we can learn to do that, if we can learn to say, I want to be the best I can be, but I'm going to have some flaws and some nicks and some dents along the way, but I keep loving myself and I keep going forward. And, you know, it takes work to develop that attitude. And sometimes we have to go very deep. I do this, you know, my program. We have to go underneath all those thoughts to find out what's at the core, you know, what's the core of I'm not good enough. No one will ever love me. I'll never love myself. You know, let me go way down in there and root that out.
Yeah.
Work on reframing that.
Yeah, it's a very, very important part of the work we must do.
Yes.
I mean, it certainly is intrinsically linked with our eating, overeating, and just reaching and grabbing and gobbling and whatever.
Well, it's true, because if you feel terrible about yourself, you're not going to care, and you're just going to want something. You're going to want to grab those hyper-palatable foods that are going to create bliss in your brain in about 3 minutes, and you're not going to worry anymore today about how much you hate yourself. But the problem is, it's all going to start tomorrow.
Yes. Yes.
Right? And so, every emotional eater knows this, that there is no resolution, you know, and no recovery in the ice cream or the chocolate cake.
No, there isn't.
The recovery is in the work. And the good news is, what I like to tell people is, the good news is there is recovery, and there is complete recovery, and there is hope. And there are a bunch of steps to take. There are what I call self-care skills that you can learn.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first five skills in the book are self-care skills that will help you get yourself into emotional balance.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can learn the body balancing principles that will balance out your body chemistry and brain chemistry. And then you can learn soul care skills, you know, to address where your soul and spirit are kind of off balance. And you can start anywhere with any of those skills, whatever you like. If you feel like addressing the body stuff first, you want to go to the spiritual stuff first. And once you start practicing all those skills and you really get them in place, you will be dramatically further on your road, and recovery is possible. I'm living, walking, breathing example of every single thing I write in the book. I've been.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on my show. I really enjoyed this very much, and I think what you are offering here is truly transformational.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been my total pleasure to articulate all this to your listeners.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to be playing the music for it. Let me just quickly repeat your website, which is, I just put my glasses somewhere. I love that. Overeatingrecovery.com.
Yeah, easy to remember.
Right.
Overeating
yes,
Recovery.
Yes. And good luck to you, and enjoy everything that you're doing as what you teach. It's great.
Yes, and thank you again for having me. It's just been my total pleasure.
Thank you. I'm going to be playing music for Mother and Child by Klaus D. Jensen.